Hey, Tim.
Hello there, Dweck.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. I've been under the weather for the past week or so, but I think I'm finally on the up and up.
Yeah, that's good.
I blame it all on my wife. She had a what's it called? A bug or something going around her job, and then she brought it home last weekend, and then both of us have been struggling with congestion and coughing
right.
throughout
the
week.
Yeah, I've had the same thing for like a week now. It's crazy. Not a couple days, but it's like, yeah. It's
the worst.
Yeah. I've been so excited for this. You don't have to feel bad about, like, you know, anything, because I'm always so bad at this, too. I'm like,
I didn't put it on my calendar. I'm like, oh, fuck. And I checked Facebook late that night. I was like, oh, god damn it.
Yeah, I'm always very flexible with it, because, you know, comics are always busy, and you have like a job and stuff like that's actually probably takes up a lot of your time. Because how long have you been a therapist for?
I got my license in 2016, so about 5 years, and before that I was doing internships for about 2 years, so 5 years officially licensed with the state of New Jersey.
Wow, I've been to therapy before, and I've never heard about like the other side of it, which is interesting. Like, you know, what made you get into that?
I had one of those existential conversations years ago with my wife, you know, girlfriend at the time, just trying to figure out, you know, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? And she had just offhandedly suggested, based off of what I was, you know, telling her about who I am and what's important to me, she said, have you ever considered counseling? And I never thought about, oh yeah, let's be a therapist. So from that conversation, I did a little bit of research, and I realized, oh wow, a lot of these counseling programs, these mental health masters programs that are out there, a lot of their philosophy, and I guess you can say like mission statements, align with who I am as a person. And then I did a bit more research, and like, okay, this sounds like something that I could do. It's a career path. It's got, you know, it's something substantial. And then one thing led to another, and then found some local programs, and I ended up going to Monmouth University in West Long Branch for my program, and it's been working out since.
Right. Yeah. So, I can't even imagine, like, so like, what kind of stuff do you have to like learn? Like, that's probably a broad question, but like,
well, it's a lot of, I would say, communication skills. I don't have the title that prescribes medications, but we have to understand medications, because obviously we see people who are medicated.
Yeah, for sure.
So I would say medications, communication. There's been a big push over the past couple of years to get more multiculturally educated, because everything is not the, you know, cis white male, you know,
right, of course,
as much as that has been the mold. And not just diversity in terms of race, but I have a real appreciation for people that I talk to with physical disabilities, like epilepsy, for example. If I go to a concert, I'm never questioning, oh, I hope I can survive and not have a seizure with the, you know, strobe lights.
Right.
I've never been in a wheelchair, so for me to have the knowledge of, oh, some people aren't able to go down curbs if there isn't the handicap accessible, you know, drop into the street.
Right.
So being more attentive to a world outside of your own. So pretty much communication, obviously mental health in general, you know, what these conditions are, what is bipolar, what is schizophrenia, what is borderline personality. That is,
right,
is the crux of what we learn. Medications, communication, how to deal with families, how to do couples counseling. That pretty much is like a nice summation of that.
Yeah, I'm kind of familiar with schizophrenia, because I had that. I had like a, it's never come back, but I had this experience in high school where I had a manic break for like 3 months, and one of it was that, and it was crazy. Hallucinations was insane. I wasn't sleeping, so it was like you never knew, like, you were awake or when you weren't. So it was like I was good with that. I was with my family, and they never had me, like, go to a place or anything. They just pretty much beat it, like, knew they could beat it themselves, thought they could. So, mm-hmm. and they did. So it was like 3 months and got on medication and everything. And I haven't had anything since then.
Wow.
But it was crazy 3 months of, like,
yeah, you're, you know, super fortunate for that.
Hallucinations and shit. And, like, that's stuff that's very scary, like, to think, because you're seeing shit that you don't, that's not there. You're hearing shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, it's like, you know, your reality is completely changed. Crazy.
And, but, and the biggest thing with that is that people hear, you know, psychosis, hallucinations, seeing things that aren't there, and they automatically assume, you know, cause, you know, oh, they're gonna hurt me. When you are in that state, you probably, obviously, I'm you know, making,
yeah,
to me,
I was always afraid of hurting other people or being like, or yeah, hurting myself. I was,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. That was my thing. I was like, you don't want to walk in the traffic. Like, that's what you think is gonna happen. You, yeah, think you're, yeah, gonna, yeah, walk off of the top of a building. That's what you feel like you're gonna do, because you're like, I haven't been sleeping. I don't know where I'm walking.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's,
yeah,
and it's tough.
A lot of times, not having enough sleep will cause hallucinations unrelated to schizophrenia. So when people are you know, in a manic state, or obviously if they're doing drugs and they haven't slept in like 3 days, shit will get scary.
Oh, yeah.
Just by not being able to sleep.
Yeah, it's a crazy thing to happen, but I just have that now that I sort of. I know what that is for people, and that's,
yeah,
that's a lot of, that's a thing though. But with the one thing I've noticed, sort of, I don't know if there's a correlation, I guess I do as like a common nerd, I like to think there's a connection to it, but do you feel like as a therapist, like it's helped with your comedy?
I would say 100%. One of the biggest things that people often ask is, do your patients give you material? And I'm like, well, that, like, I get where that question comes from, but I like your question better. Has it influenced? Which is 100% the case, but not in the traditional way that people say, oh, I bet you get a lot of material from those crazy people. How it's helped is I get such a better understanding of what sets people off.
Right.
The things that, like, I mean, comedy is all about the things that bring us together, you know, relatability and whatnot. And when I hear moms or wives or whoever is, like, taking care of the house stuff complain about laundry and dishes, like, I get why moms have mental breakdowns because someone hasn't done the dishes for the third week in a row.
Right.
And that's why people get divorced. You know, it's not the infidelities. It's not the, you know, the big stuff, because people, those are usually one and done things.
Right.
But it's the stuff that is persistent, that's there every day, but it's not that bad. It's like Chinese water torture.
Right.
And when I hear people talk about all these things, it makes me think, like, oh yeah, why do I keep hearing this? I would say that the most recent thing is, this is pretty common in, like, late adolescents, people in their 20s, I keep hearing, I want more out of life, but I don't know, you know, where to go or what to do or how to get it. And I think that if I simply talk about the things that a lot of my clients talk about, not the individual specific stuff that, you know, individuals have gone through, but more like the general struggles of anxiety and just not knowing how this whole life thing works out.
Right.
In that sense, I feel more relatable to audiences because I'm talking about things that affect much, you know, like the larger range of the audience, as opposed to something specific that my brain comes up with as like a bit that I think is really funny, but that's more specific to me as opposed to, well, what reaches a larger audience?
Yeah, because I think, like, one of my things I think with stand-up is, like, you have to be, like, even if you're not, like, a super observational comic, which I'm not, is, like, you have to be inquisitive about life.
Yeah.
You have to be like, what is going on? Like, that's what sort of has to be in your head of like, what's going on? In the general scope of just everything of like examining stuff and what's. And so I always like that with your comedy because it's like, I would say it's intellectual, but I don't want to be like heavy handed in that. It's just really like cool how you think of stuff.
Yep. I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other day, and he said that something to the effect of that I try to, and he wasn't trying to be heavy handed either, but he's like, but Tim, you try to blow people's minds. when it comes to like thinking of a topic. And I have an animal cruelty bit. I don't know if you ever heard me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like stuff like that, where you take a concept, which is, you know, generally accepted by like everyone. And if you're able to turn it on its head and get people to think like, oh man, I never saw it that way, but it kind of makes sense. You're phrasing it. That to me is the most fun when you challenge a previously just, you know, accepted thought that's never been challenged, and then you turn it on its head and you make a whole new perspective out of it.
Right. There's this comedian, I can't remember his name. I want to remember his name, but he has this joke about like the terms for like anal sex throughout different like countries and different places, and he's like, it's all like geographical.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they say like dirt road, and then some say like, you know, like Fudge Mountain and stuff.
Reminds
me of you, like, with just the wordplay that you do and everything. And I wanted to talk to you about that because I know we're both huge fans of Carlin. Like, how has that sort of influenced you with the wordplay, like, and everything that you do with that?
I remember the first time that I realized that comedy can be poetic. I hadn't been doing comedy yet, but I was pretty young. It was probably like in my, I don't know, late teens or early 20s. I saw a clip of Carlin doing the Coast to Coast Emergency, when he talks about like the big fire that just sweeps the whole country. And I don't know if you're familiar with that bit.
Right. Yeah.
and that towards the end, he says, you know, that this big storm is just, you know, it's a big pool of bitterness and hate. And it suddenly explodes into a million, you know, a trillion tiny stars. And each star has a trillion tiny planets. And when I was watching that, I thought, oh, wow, this is actually quite beautiful. And the lights went down and like the whole scenery of the stage at the Beacon Theater changed. And I was like, wow, this is beautiful and it's artistic. And it's not hilarious. Like, I'm not being blown away
right
by laughter. I'm being blown away by the artistry and the creativity of it. So that is... I think that special was like 2005 or something.
Yeah.
So I was like a junior in high school. And I had always been, I have a background as well. My undergraduate is in writing. So I've before comedy, I was doing quite a few poetry open mics. And I think once I started to blend the creativity of the poetry without being funny, and I started to write bits, I was like, oh, I can have the best of both worlds here. And,
right.
And certainly, you know, Carlin's wordplay, I don't think I've ever tried to mimic it or
mirror it. No, I wouldn't say that. It's just is like, as someone who likes that style, correct. Like, I love that style. Like, I actually have a playlist on Spotify of like all those type of bits, like from Carlin and other people, of like, they're just linguistic like bits that are just,
I love them
because they're, I don't know why, I just like them so much. And they're just, it's so cool to see like people be able to write like really clever stuff and be like, oh, I wish I could do that.
Mike Kaplan can get a bit into that as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
Gary Goleman.
Gary Goleman is another good one in terms of they're all on that playlist. Is making fun. Yeah, everyone like. It's so cool. So when did you start getting into stand up? When did you start doing it?
I about 2 months into grad school. I started grad school and comedy around the same time. So this is my first set was at Stress Factory in December of, I want to say 13. I think so, yeah. And then I did it another time a couple months later. I hadn't been taking it seriously. And then in the summer is when I started going to 10th Street. So like I started taking it seriously in the summer of 2014. How it started was I actually had been wanting to do it since I was in like high school, but just, you know, I wasn't writing. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't want to make a fool of myself. But a couple months into grad school, I didn't have a job and I just had, you know, classes all day and I was living down the shore at the time. And I only had homework to do. And the rest of my day was just filled with a whole lot of nothing, you know, trying to find a job.
Right.
And at the time, my wife's friend had given us a old hard drive that had hours and hours of movies and music and a whole bunch of comedy specials. So those first 3 months of grad school, I would split my time between homework and just watch all these comedy specials that had been on my list for forever. I just didn't have the time to watch it. And at the end of those, towards the end of that semester, I was like, you know what? I can do this. You know, let's just write some shit down and let's just, the plan was to just do it once. Just to say that I did it. And I was fortunate that I had a couple friends come out. It was like, you know, like 8 or 10 of them. It was a great night. And then, when I did it a couple months later, I was like, okay, well, I don't think I can stop now. Like, it hasn't been tremendous. I don't know if this can be a professional thing, but like, this is, I can feel that there's no not doing it.
Right. Yeah.
And then I just, you know, looked up comedy open mics and then one thing led to another and I just kept doing it.
Yeah. To me, I always kick myself that I didn't know what open mics were. And it wouldn't have mattered because back at the time that I wasn't doing it and wanted to, there really wasn't any.
Yeah.
And there was like, it's so funny, like you mentioned that time period, like 2014 is when it started like to come around in the area that I lived in. Like Angelo pretty much started everything.
Yeah.
Which is so crazy to think like he was sort of the catalyst because I was doing improv at the time because there was nothing else to do. There was no way to get into stand-up. Like there was the, there was of course like, I think the Stress Factory, of course, and there was, and that was too far. And there was, Venues was close, but they only did professional.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, so I guess I'll do improv for, you know, and that was interesting because Mike, who teaches that, he taught an improv like drama class like in my middle school, and so I knew him from there, and I knew, like, from my sister's age of people that he did this improv thing that was very popular with them. So I was in my – I took this vocal class when I was in high school, and that's how I started, like, performing. I was started with singing, and it was, like – that's when I realized, like, oh, this is, like – I can be in front of a crowd and do this and perform. And then I saw that flyer, and I did it, and I was, like, 16 at the time. And
– You started improv when you were 16?
When I was 16, yeah. And I met Heather Lowry there.
Yep.
So it was like crazy how the people that I met. And then a few years after that, like in 2015, we started performing at Where Music Lives in what's that area called? Oh, I always forget the name. I usually remember it. But it's this place called Where Music Lives. And it was like a small music, like a small music hall of fame.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have comedians there that would open for us. So there was Mark Henley and a couple other people. And I don't know if you know him because he doesn't really do stand-up anymore, but Dylan Monegan.
Yeah. I remember him.
Was in my improv troupe. So I asked him, like, after I did it, like, because what happened was my teacher was like, do you want to do it sometime, like open the show for us? And I said yes, but I did it twice and I bombed terribly. But the way I explained it is I could have flown off the stage. I would have gotten up like 5 seconds later and been like, this is awesome.
Oh,
like I was so happy to finally do it because it was like
yeah
built up. So I asked Dylan afterwards, and I was like, where do I go? And he told me all the places to go to. And I was like, okay, this is where we're going. And then I did improv for like another year. And then I was like, this is over.
Yeah. And at the time that I started, around the same time that you're describing, I was, because I was going to school, I was living down in Highlands. So being down the shore, you're right, Angelo did start quite a bit. I would frequent Brighton Bar quite a bit. There was a couple that would, you know, pop up here and there. I know there was one in Asbury. I don't know if it was the Where Music Lives. That
place. That's in Cookman. I just remembered that.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. I'm Cookman. There was that bank that kept changing hands so often.
Yeah.
And I would hang out in Red Bank quite a bit. The Dublin House.
Yeah, I went to the Dublin House. That was one of my second. That was the second place I went to.
Yeah,
and then
so I was grateful that there was a couple local spots, and then of course I would travel up to 10th Street on Mondays, and it took me a while before I got into the city pretty regularly. I don't go into the city as frequently as perhaps I should now, but with as much stage time as people can get in Jersey, I don't think you really. I mean, if you want to try to hit like three open mics a night, obviously you would want to live in Manhattan or Brooklyn. Yeah. But that's very cliquish. I don't think you're
getting... everyone I've heard says it's very cliquish, and I never did that. Like my whole thing in New York is my parents and like my friends kind of miss it, that like, and I can't really explain it to them why I don't do it anymore, is doing bringer shows, because they like to go to them. But it's like, nah, they're like a scam. I can't do them. But there was like, whenever I did them, it was always cool because, and it was like cool to have that assignment of like, okay, I have a show in a month. I can, make up this material and work on it for 3 weeks and then go and do it and be like, okay, this is great. And then like, I had little things. Like I always knew it was bad. I was like, well, I'm performing on a stage where other comedians that I love have performed on and there's an audience and whatever. And I did that for a while. I did like six of them, and they were always, it was good because like I got tape and stuff, but back then I was so bad, and it's so like cool to look back at stuff now and like see how you evolve on stage.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that I tie in to therapy quite often. A lot of times people look back with such disgust at who they used to be, either as a person or as a performer, and they're like, oh god, like that, what was I thinking, that's so bad, and oh, it's so embarrassing. What that really means though is that we're no longer that person,
right?
And we have the luxury of being able to look back and say, well, now I know that that's no longer me, because I have this huge embarrassment over, I'm never going to do that stuff again. And
right,
what's relieving and also terrifying about that thought is perhaps in another 5 or 10 years, we can look at the versions of who we are right now and be embarrassed at who we are in this moment.
Oh, of course, yeah.
It just means that we're constantly evolving.
So how do you just, I don't know how to word this question, but do you think, like, is it a lot of, like, just empathy, like, learning to say the right things when you're, like, a therapist? Like, is that, I imagine that would be what it is. Like having to realize how to talk to people.
I would say that half of what therapists, and I'm just making up numbers here. I don't know what the actual percentage is, but about half of what we do is learned, and the other half is just an innate, I think, ability to connect with people and to the same way a comedian reads an audience.
Right.
One of the things that I really pride myself about the career that I have is being able to disarm people really well. I've had quite a few people who come in and either they're brought in under duress or their family thinks they're crazy, and then you got to talk to someone and their arms are folded, as Brody Stevens would say, arms crossed, negative energy.
Right.
And by the end of the session, someone is looking forward to coming back and talking again.
Right.
I don't know how teachable a skill like that is, but it obviously has a lot to do with empathy and just an ability to not quote unquote know what someone needs, but getting an impression off of what they're saying, how they're saying it, body language, that are XYZ has happened in their life, or XYZ isn't what they need. What is it that this person needs? Maybe not forever, but in this moment, what could alleviate whatever it is that they're struggling with?
Right.
You can't know that unless someone is honest and forthcoming. So you have to take what they say at face value and hope that they're not just, you know, pulling your leg.
Right. Yeah. For me, that was always a thing that was like always reassuring to me. Like, I always liked therapy when I started going on. I was like 14, and I loved it because, like, it was just cool. Like, you see, like, it was like reassuring. You see, like, the accomplishments and everything on the wall and all the graduation stuff. And it's like, yeah, they've done this. And, you know, it's funny. My current guy that I have is for my medication. And I got linked up with him when I switched schools, and I didn't really like him back then. And we're still not as, like, close as I have been with other therapists because, like, it was just back then at that time when I was, you know, 16, 17.
Yeah.
And, like, now it's like, I don't talk to him about certain things. But, like, now it's like, I just say I'm a lot nicer. which is weird because I was always with other therapists just very, like, open and, you know, I never was, like, the, like, arms crossed type of person. I was always, like, I like talking and I liked the conversational thing. And
yeah.
It was always the thing that I liked. And then the last person I had was kind of like more spiritual based, which was really weird because I wasn't like into that, but it was like, she was cool anyway. And it was just like, but that was just interesting to sort of deal with that and be like, okay, see that perspective.
I often tell people finding the right therapist is like finding the right pet. You can have, you know, all kinds of dogs come in your house, but not all of them are going to be the exact fit for you. You got to sometimes lean through the more difficult ones and find the right one for you.
Right. So are you pretty open with, like, when I don't know if I can ask this, but when you have your like sessions, are you pretty open with, like, what's going on with your life to relate to them, or is it pretty, like, focused on them?
The technical term of what you're asking is called self-disclosure.
Right.
For me, I wouldn't say I'm an open book, because there definitely needs to be, you know, a healthy professional boundary.
Yeah, like a picture. Yeah.
I would say I probably share a bit more than the average clinician. Especially when it comes to people who are creative. There's a handful of people that I have mentioned that I perform. So there's a relatability there.
Right.
I talk about experiences that I have in my life only when it is beneficial to the client. It's not me talking about, oh yeah, I've been through this too, and let me tell you how bad it was for me. That is the worst way to self-disclose.
Right.
But for the most part, like, I'm not giving away my address to anyone, but it's more of a, hey, we're in this together. I haven't gone through, like, the example that I use quite often is, I've never been raped, but I know what it's like to have my power taken away, which is what sexual assault's all about.
Yeah.
So I may not be able to relate to you on that physical level, but on a different kind of emotional or intellectual level, there is a kind of understanding without having that lived experience.
Right.
Plus, male doctors deliver babies every day, and they're never going to have a baby. So,
right.
You know, we don't have to run completely parallel lives to be able to understand where someone's coming from.
Right. Of course. Yeah. So, I know we're bouncing back and forth between the comedy and the therapy, because I'm just interested in both. Like,
sure, yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah,
it's cool, like, that you ever do both. So it's like, and I always feel like, you know, like I said, they seem to go hand in hand with me. But I wanted to ask you about two things. I want to ask you about your special and your book.
Yeah.
Your special is called Free Advice. It's on YouTube. It came out in 2018, right?
Correct.
Yeah. How did that go about? How did that whole thing happen.
That was one of those things where in September, I think it was, yeah, like late summer, early fall of 2017, very similar to how I had that realization when I first decided to do stand-up. I was like, yeah, I can do this. I think I was talking to friends who had been like putting on their own shows. And I was like, how does someone do that? Like, how do you get the equipment and like and the comics and you find the venue? And I was just talking to people. I was like, oh, so you just talk to people. You just, ultimately, anything that people accomplish in life is they just end up deciding that this is what I want to do. And for, you know, just talking to friends who had run their own or produced their own shows, and the guy who produced mine was K.L. Martin.
Right.
I think him and I were just, you know, talking one day at the street, and I decided, hey, you know, I think I can probably put together a themed show where I'm not just doing a million one. And family have been asking me forever, you know, when they're going to get a chance to see me perform. And another one of those very similar to the book where it was just something that I wanted to do. I didn't have any intentions because I know Alex Nicholas is going to be filming an album soon. Gordon filmed his album a while back. Tyler's going to be doing his at the same tonight. Oh, no, next Saturday. So, you know, people are doing it. And there was like no intention of an album drop or putting it on Spotify. I just wanted to do as much time as I could, not just, you know, throwing all my material out there, have some friends and just, you know, try to make a night out of it. I wanted to give myself a bit of a challenge, and it went off pretty well. I was happy with the turnout. I made a little bit of money, and now it's on YouTube. And I think that's definitely one of those things that in a little while, if not already, I can look back and say, oh man, what was I doing? Those jokes don't represent me anymore.
Right. But you were like, 4 or 5 years in when you did that?
Yeah. Cause even though I started it, you know, towards the end of 13, it was really, you know, I would say probably the summer of 2015 when I really started to do it more often. Actually, I would say more so because I moved from Highlands to Roselle Park 5 years ago. So that was 20. So I had probably only had been doing it seriously, like every other day, every day, going into the city most weekends to do 3 or 4 mics for about 2 years at the mm-hmm. point that I did Free Advice. And I remember KL telling me that there were a few comedians who went up to him asking, this is according to KL, no one came up to me directly. So, you know, KL is an honest guy and I'll take his word for it. Mm-hmm. Other comedians came up to him asking, like, essentially, who the hell do I think that I am to, you know, do a special? And he's only been doing it for X amount of years, and blah, you know, how people usually talk, you know, all
yeah, yeah, of course, stuff. Yeah.
So yeah, I'd only been doing it. I would say probably hitting the ground running for about 2, maybe 3 years at that point.
Right.
And with the book, that was a project that I gave myself through a group of my friends. We got together throughout the pandemic when nothing was happening, and we would Zoom and pretty much talk shop and give each other homework assignments week in and week out. And one of them came from Angela Sharp. She had said, all right, I want everyone to give yourself 5 things that you want to accomplish by the end of this year, meaning 2021. Because I think we had been meeting for a while. We started in like May of last year, and I think we wrapped up maybe around like October, probably around this time last year. So we met on Zoom for like a solid 6 or 7 months. Right. And she said, for next year, what are 5 goals that you wish to accomplish? And one of them was for me, was write a book. I keep my notes really organized on my on a jump drive. I have a folder of, you know, it's labeled comedy material. You open the folder and it's just, I don't know, like 3 or 4 dozen topics. Mm-hmm. And each one is a different document of, you know, race, religion, sex, whatever.
Yeah, Dan does that.
Caprio, who does that? Who?
Caprio, he does that.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, him and I talk about organization all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So I figured I have so many pages, and I can probably just format and put this together. And again, not looking to get it picked up by anything. I'm not looking to make a fortune. It's just one of those things that a challenge that I want to give myself to do. And I did it, and it's out there. And, you know, that was the end goal there, just to do that too.
Yeah. It's so cool to hear about, like, people doing stuff like that. Like, when I went to Texas, there's a host there that's only 2 years in, and somehow he got this huge theater in Texas there, the Stateside Paramount Theater, to give him a special. And he's only 2 years in. And he had, like, 50 minutes. And I watched, and it was, you know, he's 2 years in. But he was, like, it was, like, just astounding to be, like, to be able to do that and, like, actually commit to it and be like, yeah, he wrote enough material to do 50 minutes in 2 years. And it's just fantastic. It's just so cool to, like, see people do stuff like that and get stuff done, you know, because that's the only thing now that I realized, like, if you want something really with this, you have to do it yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really interesting. Like, with me, when I started doing this podcast, it was just me, you know, rambling. And then in the start of the pandemic, I always wanted to interview people, but I hadn't. And then I started interviewing people in the pandemic. And now I've interviewed, like, close to 70 people now.
Oh, wow.
And it's just crazy because we know so many people, and then you always meet new comedians. And that's always a mix. You know, we're like, I'm like, I love being new comedians. And then it's like, there's way too many comedians in the world.
Yeah, you're 100% right about if you want something, you just have to go after it. Any like biography or interview that I've ever read or watched with, like, you know, quote unquote successful people, the interviewer will ask, how did you create this empire? How did you do it? And it's really as simple as time and again, the person just says, it's what I decided I wanted, and I went after it. Now, maybe that's an oversimplification. Maybe there are things that get in the way. But ultimately, no one, I love thinking about how no one is looking for me. No one is, no one is, you know, in contact with Tim Lowe. No one is trying to seek me out. And that could sound so debilitating and, oh, I'm a nobody, I'm a nothing. But it's more like no. That needs to be my motivation. If no one is looking for me right now, then I have to be so undeniable and so funny and so creative and so out there and trying new things and taking risks that it's going to be hard not to get noticed. So the more that is my mentality, the easier it is to follow through on things like books and specials. And
yeah, that's really good. Yeah. I would think, like, anyone who, like, says anything is, like, the same thing with, like, that I've heard with Dan. It's just, like, you can't worry about that. Like, people just do what they're gonna do, and people always have their reaction to everything. But, like, I always think, if you're gonna, you know, do it, you gotta shoot for it. You gotta, you know, that's the only way things are gonna get done.
No one's gonna come and do it for you.
Right. So I just was curious. You mentioned you watched all those specials. Do you remember which ones they were?
I got the most was definitely Bill Hicks.
I like him.
What's that?
I like him. I watched his. I watched, like, I listened to, like, a lot of his stuff last year, and yeah, it was just cool to like see that, like such a small anthology of like what he did, because there really wasn't a whole lot of stuff. But
yeah, because he died when he was 32, and I'm definitely not like a, you know, ride or die Bill Hicks, because you know his is a bit of a time capsule, you know, late 80s, early 90s. But what stuck out to me was the creative and how well, when I say creative language, I mean like he would get like really graphic.
Yeah.
And, like the whole, you know, there's this whole Rush Limbaugh bit where he's getting peed in a tub, or peed on in a tub. And I felt like, wow, this is gross, and it's graphic, and it's you know, skeezing a bunch of people out. But I love the risks that he took, and how he was going against the grain. Like America was like such a great place to be in the late 80s, and you know, Reagan and all these amazing men. And he was able to, you know, see through a lot of that bullshit.
Yeah.
And to rail against popular opinion at that time must have been, you know, so difficult, because I'd never heard comedians go against Ronald Reagan. I'm thinking he was, you know, he had such a landslide second election victory. Every state went red. Like the guy. And so I was impressed that so many of those contrarian thoughts that really opened my eyes to, I tend to think a bit outside the box, and let's see if I can take some of those thoughts into you know, my own creative endeavors.
Yeah,
so it was mostly Hicks.
It's interesting to see how but I mean, to cut you off, but how pop culture has like changed, and like not really changed, but like how it's sort of evolved, and like social media and everything. And the one thing I always think about is like, I know for sure Bill Hicks would never be on social media at all. He would absolutely hate it. He would think like people are just getting stupider. And
I
just imagine like he would come out with a special and it'd be like a Chappelle thing of like, what did he say? But it's like,
he would definitely be one of those people who isn't being summoned or is bowing down to anybody's will.
Yeah, so I always like that about him. He was so cool to like watch that. And yeah, it's like a time period thing of like, yeah, he was, you know, really. So who else was there that you watched?
Okay. I think that's when I really opened up much more to Carlin as well. I had seen a couple, and I knew of him, but I never really gave him like the full attention of an entire special. David Cross. I got back into Mike Birbiglia as well.
A lot of early Mike Birbiglia I relate to a lot with how my material used to be, and still kind of is. Like, I don't do, like, the storytelling that he does, but, like, the, like, early stuff that he does, I relate to a whole bunch. And, I saw him what was it? Thank God for Jokes?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And, I remember liking it, but, that's just crazy to be able to, that's a whole other thing of being able to do, like, a long-form, like story arch thing as opposed to like regular stand-up.
Yeah, that's always been impressive, where not just him but people who tell similar kind of, you know, stories, where it opens up with some sort of anecdote and then it goes into the, you know, the show, and then the end of the show kind of brings it back to what that first anecdote was. And it's, oh, wow, I just saw, you know, the whole thing. There it is in, you know, complete picture. It's really quite impressive to get to that level.
Right. And there's actually, I almost forgot about this. It was crazy because, like, I thought I had it written down. But I want to talk to you about this because I know you sort of been interested in this. And it's perfect with the the memorabilia special I just talked about is the whole cancel culture thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is very like I have such a I've been trying to like find a way to describe my feelings on it because it's so mixed. It's I always say stand up is both simplistic and nuanced.
Yes.
So it's like it's really tough to explain to normal functioning people. Like this is it. Yeah. So like I just remember like people saying like, oh, Tim wants to be canceled now. And I'm like, I just think he's trying to write jokes that are, you know, just like doing that. Like you always do that. Like you're always doing some type of thing that has that goal of like, so I just wanted to get like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, wouldn't self-describe as like, oh, I'm an edgy comic who pushes the limits. That's such a, ugh.
I don't think you're that. Yeah. Like
that. It's more of the, you know, trying to get people to challenge, you know, trying to challenge people essentially.
Yeah.
With my, you know, quote unquote, getting my, obviously it's ridiculous.
Right.
It's silly. It's absurd. you know, when people do get canceled, they apologize. Oh, I'm sorry if I offended anyone. So no one wants to get canceled. I'm making a sham of the whole thing because it's silly and it's ridiculous.
Right.
To the extent that people go to, you know, cancel things because, you know, no one, you know, the whole he without sin cast the first stone.
Right.
You know, in truth, anyone could get canceled because we all have a past that is at times, you know, unpleasant.
Oh yeah.
So the you know, to your point about it's subtle and nuanced. Yeah, that's the whole point. When someone says something that is quote unquote offensive, which I don't even know what that means anymore. Offensive. There certainly are there comedians who you can't really tell. Like there's a lot of lying, and it's, you know, is this how someone actually feels? Because they're doing a good job.
That's a lot of it that is.
Yeah, the amount that actually occurs is very small. Like I think Nick DiPaolo was a good example where it's hard to find the line between where the comedian and the person, you know, where that blending. There's a whole lot of blurring of lines with him. He's like an angry, you know, white guy who's, oh, the kids these days and everyone's too soft.
Right.
I've never been a particular fan of him, so I haven't actually watched enough to make a full opinion on him, so maybe I'm speaking out of turn.
All I know about him is that he used to be, like I guess a decade ago, like, people say, like, he was, like, a normal comic, like, but now it's, like, it's way too, political now, like extreme.
Yeah.
He's like Dennis Miller now.
Yes, yes.
So it's kind of like that.
Because what ends up happening is that you have these polarizing sides. The more that people get triggered and they get incensed by, oh, I can't believe what so-and-so said, we have to, you know, go after all of their work and, you know,
right.
From performing, that's going to create a proportionate opposite reaction on the other side of the coin. I think the best example of that is I have a brother who lives in Portland, and everyone, you know, knows Portland is this hyper liberal and blah blah. If you go 5 minutes outside of Portland in any direction, it is Confederate flags all over the place.
Right.
So when that small liberal, relatively liberal town is surrounded by that conservative, both of those extremes are going to get amplified more and more.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing in comedy. Chappelle is not going to, you know.
Yeah. Irks me though, like about the whole entire discussion with this is always people don't understand that it goes in every direction. Like,
yeah.
You know, how much it feels like I'm going crazy when it's like, you know, the Christian right gets offended by everything, right?
Yeah.
And offended by little Nas, like Nas X or whatever, like doing the devil, like lap dance or whatever you did on this music video. And it's like, everyone has their thing. Like, I just saw a thing in, like, an interview with Anthony Jeselnik, which is, like, perfect. It's like, yeah, everyone has their lines.
Yes.
And you might think, you don't have a line. You do. And
yeah. You recently posted that Anthony Jeselnik quote, right?
Yeah, yeah. I just thought it was very telling of, like, yeah, he's like, you know, I used to do this joke, and now, like, my father's sick, so I don't think, like, that topic's funny. But, like, you know, he's like, that's my line, but I'm not going to tell other people not to laugh at it.
Yeah. And it's I think the people that get offended and so bothered that they, you know, are up in arms, like, they must live such boring lives. Like, I can't think of a worse way to waste your energy, not accomplishing anything and feeling that you know, that there's going to be an impact. it's like, there are, what confuses me is that there are so few hills that I'll die on. There are so few things that I feel so impassioned about. Like, I'm actually jealous of these people that they are so invested in, you know, getting offended and trying to cancel someone. I've never been that impassioned about anything.
Right.
And I wish that I had like a fraction of that kind of energy.
Right. But, I think a lot of that is, it also depends on what they are. Like, if it's a regular, like, sort of overly progressive, like, white person, there's that, like, you were talking about, like, you know, in knowing with your, like, therapy, having to learn that. Like, a lot of, like, you know, I get a lot of flack for sort of my mixed opinion on the Chappelle special. And it's like, I have a ton of trans comedians that I'm friends with. So, like,
yeah.
I'm sort of inundated with both sides that I hear constantly talking about it.
Yeah.
Where it's like,
yeah.
I want to be like, you know, you want to feel a certain way, or you think like, oh, it's not a big deal. But then you have to realize there are these people that you're friends with that this stuff sort of impacts. And it's interesting. There's a transgender comic in Philly that we go to when we go to Bar 13. And she recently said that she did a joke about the whole Chappelle thing on especially, that was basically like, she's like, rogue parent. She said like, she felt really bad because she was conflicted between being a comic and being trans, and sort of how you deal in that community, because they just dogpile you if you're a comic in that way and you fall to one side. And I thought like, that must be so like hard to be in that position where you're like, because we're kind of a species of our own. Like, I think Seinfeld said it, like, comedians are just their own species. So it's like, what side are you on?
Yeah it can be a real challenge for people who fit a particular demographic, but they don't share values. Tim Dillon talks about this all the time, about him being gay, but he's often, because of his material and because of his perspective, is often seen as like a right-wing Nazi nut who's you know, conspiracy and theorist.
He's a, like, to me, I always know him as there's a rapper, I think his name's Tom McDonald, and he's like a middle ground guy that everyone thinks is Republican, and he's a rapper. Yeah. And it's like, no, he's middle ground. It just is, you hear so much from, you know, just main pop culture and everything, the one side, that when you hear just a little bit of the center, it feels like the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, no, this is center people thinking.
Yeah. So it has less to do with the demographic that you're in, and more to a point of, make sure that you are aligned with the values that demographic, or the message that demographic wants you to push.
Right. Yeah.
Cool. I imagine it's a lot like, you know, being like a Black Republican. How can that exist? Like,
well, oh yeah,
I mean, it anything can exist. You know, when we're stuck in this like pigeonholed, things have to be a particular way. We don't really open ourselves up to alternative possibilities. It's just, no, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, then it has to be a duck all the time. There are no geese. There are no swans. Everything has to be this thing. It's like we're severely limiting ourselves.
Yeah, it's always cool to like sort of see that mix. Like I think just people, and I think you see that a lot in comedy too. Like I like the one thing I like about open mics is when they're really good is when it's people of all different type of backgrounds and everything. Like that's what I liked about going to the co-op and everything, because it was always different pockets of people there.
Yeah.
So, okay. Let me figure out. Do you have any story? This is a fun thing that I do. Do you have any stories of like a heckler or any type of thing like that that like sticks out to you?
I did a bit about people having Down syndrome being selfish because they have an extra 23rd chromosome. As if they don't have enough already. Not a great joke.
I see the humor.
Yeah. I'm glad that some people do. This was at 10th Street, probably within like my first like year or two. And I imagine this guy had a family member who had some sort of disability or something like that. And I forget what he said, but he's like, you see the light flashing? That means your time is up. You're done. And then we had a brief back and forth. And then for like the rest of the night, he kept telling all the other performers how much better they were than me.
Wow.
But I've been pretty fortunate in that as much as. I do tend to have material that's provocative and thought provoking. Usually some will make a comment, and I'm not the greatest on my feet in terms of like heckler retaliation or like comebacks.
Yeah.
So they'll make a comment, I'll say something back, and I'll just go on with the rest of my set. Not a whole lot. I'm pretty boring when it comes to like drama or anything like that.
Right.
I think I've certainly offended people. I've had really awkward bombs in my life where it's right. Like, ooh, I am not making anyone make any noise up here at all.
Right.
But the point where I needed to, walk off stage with my tail getting into a fight or anything like that.
I used to be like that, and now I've just like realized in the past year, and I don't know, I think it's with COVID too and everything, it's just like I don't have any time for any more bullshit, so I'm a lot more meaner on stage and like like not mean, but like when I get up there, like if I notice people are being like a bad crowd, I'll be like, I noticed you guys were being bad. I noticed that. Mm.
So you've grown to be more confrontational.
I remember I was at a couple weeks ago, I was at Nipahuck, and maybe it was like a month ago, and there was this family there of this dad and his son was like, one son was like 5 and one son was like 13. And he was just, heckling a little bit, just talking like not in a mean way, but I was getting annoyed. So when I went up on stage, I threatened to shit on his chest while his kids watched. I was just like, that's what I'm going to do. Like, don't heckle me. I am only up here for 4 minutes. I don't have time. Say when I go on my tirades like that, when I'm going like a back crowd, I'll be like, I'm doing this 6 years. I don't have time for
that. Probably the most fun I had watching someone else bomb, I was at one of Elazar's mics.
Oh, that's
and, Kyle Groom. Was having a rough time, and people were talking, and he said, after this woman was throughout the whole thing, and he said some of the effect of, I hope you live forever so you have to sit and watch everyone that you love around you die.
Oh yeah. He talked about that. He talked about how that almost got him banned.
Yeah, it got pretty like everyone's like whoa, and everyone got all up in arms, and Elazar had to apologize to everyone, and the patrons were saying how I'm never going to come back here again. So like, I like a good environment like that where you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of that.
I think that just always happens with a comic. Like, you just have that thing where it's like, you know, you got to have that point on stage where it's like, you know, I deserve to be up here, you know?
Yes, yeah. And that's a big pet peeve of mine when people get really excited to hear, oh, you're a comedian, that's so cool. And then you start acting like a comedian and everyone pulls back. That's like, right. Well, what is your definition? Like, we're tricksters. We don't like rules. We're going to push the envelope. We're going to get in trouble. We're going to do the things that we're not supposed to do.
Right.
We're not just some, you know, why the chicken crossed the road? Ain't I cute? Kind of thing. It can be that, but I think far too many people have a very limited scope of what comedy and especially stand up comedy really entails.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've been paying attention to the John Mulaney thing at all.
No, I just know that him and Olivia Munn are now pregnant. And...
yeah. Well, anyway, he has this segment of fans that, regardless of how many times he's told them, like, I used to do drugs, he's very open with, like, his life and, like, his past. But they still just view him, they refuse to view him in that way. So whenever he acts in that way, of, like, that's the way he is, problems, it's like they flip out over it and they don't understand it. And it's like he just told you in 3 specials that he used to do drugs and that he has like all these problems.
Yeah.
And then you get like like scandalized through.
Yes. It's so much easier to see Chris Farley as a drug addict, problematic, you know, person.
Yeah.
Because that's he lived his life like that. But with John Mulaney and his material, it's like, oh, he's squeaky clean. He's the next Jerry Seinfeld. He's like, no. He's just as much of a fucked up addict as any other buddy.
Yeah. So that's sort of like a thing that's very like weird to see how people react. And it's the same thing of like, you know, we have those expectations of what a person in that sort of field are.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much for being on.
I sincerely appreciate the invite. I don't do a whole lot of podcasts or I think that canceling myself is actually working against what I'm trying to do. Right. There hasn't been a whole lot of shows recently, so I sincerely appreciate the invite.
No, I understand. We didn't get to talk about COVID at all. I haven't booked on a show since Valentine's Day, so I'm like, this is going to be a problem. Well,
hopefully with the more things open up here and there, we'll be able to get back out there sooner than later.
Yeah, hopefully. So what's your social media stuff?
both Twitter and Instagram is The Tim Lowe. T-H-E Tim Lowe. Okay. I don't think I have anything coming up. I just did a show at Lemongrass with Josh Tinley and that guy Alex. But like I said, haven't been. I've been doing more stuff for myself. another one of those homework assignments that a bunch of my friends gave each other was to write a 22-page a pilot. And we all did that. We all read each other's scripts. I want to turn that into a full season, 24 episodes. I'm going to be doing that. And I've always had dreams of doing either a screenplay or some sort of a play.
So
I might be doing more individual stuff. Not that I won't be performing, but performing in addition to working on my own writing challenges.
Before I did stand up, that was like what I was going to do. I wanted to be a screenwriter. And
nice.
I actually met, that's how I met Liam. I met him in my, I took this class at Brookdale when I was in Brookdale, which was like a screenwriting course. And it was just like, it was so funny. Like I met him there and then a few years later, we're doing comedy together. It's like,
but small world, yeah, right?
That's a tough thing to do because like, I always loved doing creative writing and writing and stuff, but like I'm never as good as the technical aspect of writing as I want to be. So it's like creatively I'm fine. It's just grammatically I'm like, this needs to be a lot better.
Yeah.
So that's really cool that you're gonna do that, and like that's always cool to have that like next thing of like, yeah, that's a thing that you can.
Yeah, you can do. I definitely got to keep myself. I definitely got to keep myself occupied and you know something to look forward to because it can get stale very quickly.
Oh yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this, and I hope you have a good weekend.
I'm gonna do my best. You take
hope
care,
you feel better.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye.
I'll see you.